Today's episode is sponsored by Datadog, a cloud-scale monitoring platform that unifies metrics, traces, logs, and more in a single pane of glass. Automatically alert on performance anomalies, easily build custom dashboards, and collaborate to resolve issues in real time. Try Datadog for yourself with a free 14-day trial. Hansel Minutes listeners will also receive a free t-shirt. Visit bit.ly/datadogshirt. That's bit.ly.com/datadogshirt to get started. Hi, this is Scott Hansel. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes. Today I'm talking with Joseph White. He created the Pico 8, living in Japan and working at Lexalawful. Did I pronounce that correctly?
Yep, that's right.
So this started out in your bedroom in the early 90s, selling shareware, and now it is a wonderful thing online that we'll talk about.
Yeah, it's possible to trace a path quite far back. This was in New Zealand where there was no internet, really. I was using BBSs and distributing shareware on mail order catalogs.
Mm-hmm. That's how I started out, actually, doing shareware. I ran a bulletin board on Wildcat BBS.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. My boss, in fact, I didn't know this because I was a high school student in the late 80s running on Wildcat. And now, in fact, my boss at Microsoft, who owns .NET, was the guy that wrote Wildcat BBS. So now I work for him.
Small world.
Yeah, it is. So you're in Japan, and how did Pico 8 start? Pico 8, if I can understand the right way to phrase it, you call it a fantasy console. Like, I'm writing software and games for a console, but it doesn't exist. I can't buy this console.
Right. I wanted to find a term which I didn't want to call it a console emulator because, mm-hmm. That has a lot of baggage that comes with it. First of all, it implies that the machine actually existed at one point, which Pico 8 didn't. But I also wanted a way to describe it that was a little bit self-explanatory. So, the fantasy part of it sounds like it doesn't really exist, but it also sounds like it's something that, it's as you want it to be or how you want something to be.
Mm-hmm. And if you say if it's an emulator, that implies that there is a theoretical CPU and memory spec out there that a computer fits perfectly, and Pico 8 runs everywhere. Does it have a spec, though? Like, does it have a fantasy CPU?
So it kind of does, but it doesn't actually go very far down. I was tempted to, come up with an instruction set and a machine language and everything like this and build what I would call a complete vertical console or vertical fantasy console. Mm-hmm. But it only goes down to the level of feeling like there might be underlying hardware. So it goes down to a Lua virtual machine.
Mm-hmm.
And, once I had that running and I wrote some programs, that's actually when I realized, I don't actually need to, really go further than that. I can just say that it runs on the Lua virtual machine and that's it. That's enough.
Mm-hmm. And it has kind of a specification in the sense of Pico 8 games, and the interface is limited to 128 by 128 pixels, 16 color display, and 4-channel audio, right? That's the situation.
Right. So those are the important specifications. Those are the ones that are immediately obvious to the user and what gives the machine its character. Mm-hmm. So things like the screen size and the palette, they have an enormous impact on the way the machine feels to users. But in the past, they were just, byproducts of what hardware was available and market forces and things like this. Mm-hmm. But Pico 8 is an attempt to design those specifications from scratch in a way that has some sort of holistic aesthetic value to it.
Are there frames per second specifications? Or like, does everything run at 30 or 60 or something?
Yeah, it started out as 30. I felt 30 was a good sort of starting point for new users, where if you see something flash by in one frame at 60 frames per second, you can't really see what happened. At 30 frames per second, you can make animations that look good, running at 30 frames per second. Mm-hmm. But later on, there were a lot of 60 frames per second fans that kind of pushed me over the edge, and I was happy to oblige and add a 60 frames mode.
Okay, so there are in their actual independent modes, so it maintains compatibility with anything that was made before.
Right. Yeah, you need to make that conscious decision when you start a project for it to be 60 frames.
Mm-hmm. So it's 2019, and I went back in time a little bit, and I looked up the original Game Boy, because I think that's where it all started, right? Everything started at the Game Boy. And I note that the Game Boy had a screen resolution, even many, many years ago, of 160 by 144. So here you are in the 21st century making something with an extraordinarily limited screen display. Do you think that's part of its charm?
Yeah, it's so there are lots of sides to that. I wanted to go as low as I could possibly go because it was sort of interesting, as a pixel artist, when you're drawing something, it's interesting having an extremely tight constraint. And it adds a lot more to the character of the machine if it's low resolution. If I picked something mm-hmm. sort of, halfway between the Game Boy and the Famicom, the Nintendo Entertainment System or something like that, I think it sort mm-hmm. of would have been more lost in, the sort of perception of a mishmash of retro machines. It doesn't really look like anything new, whereas 128 squared looks like quite a different, shocking thing.
Yeah, it is. It is shocking, and it's like, wow, how could this be useful? It is so constrained, but the brain almost, for lack of a better word, almost fills in the lack of detail. The animations are very evocative. There's clever use of anti-aliasing, but you've only got 128 by 128 squared to go with. So your brain, at least when I think of Pico 8 games after I've played them, fills in the gaps and it becomes as high resolution as it needs to be.
Yeah, it's surprising what you can get away with at that resolution. So I think there are sort of two ways that the brain fills in the gaps.
Mm-hmm.
One is, when everything's moving and you have this extra temporal information, it's amazing how good, some three-dimensional things look. You don't really feel that low resolution. But if you show someone a still frame of the 3D object, it just looks like a big pixely mess.
Mm-hmm.
But the way that I was originally planning or hoping it would work out is that the sort of graphical styles that people would go for would be more symbolic and feel almost like a text-based game, like a text adventure or like a roguelike style aesthetic, where you're not really worrying too much about, refining visual look, but you're sort of designing tokens that are more, it feels more like board game tokens on a board or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, some of the games, and how many are there now? Thousands?
Yeah, there's between 5 and 10,000. I didn't check.
5 and 10,000. Wow. So some of the games do have that kind of token style where it's a side scroller or it's like a Zelda kind of a game, and then other ones are pushing the limits. They're both very, they're both very 8-bit in their style, but they have parallax scrolling and they have implied depth that gives you a sense of an expansive world. So you're looking at a view on something that could be tens of thousands of pixels wide or more.
Right. There's a real range of visual style in Pico 8 games and very, visually beautiful games that I didn't really expect.
Has there been a particular game or games or a style of game where you really didn't expect it? Like, you're just like, no, that is not at all what I thought you were going to be able to do. And now I love that you did it.
So I had hoped that the demo scene would latch on to Pico 8 a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And so the demo scene, for those who don't know, is a group of people making programs that you sit back and watch. And you can kind of imagine them like music videos, but everything is generated in real time. Mm-hmm. So you just create a program that has, nice music and visuals. And often the whole program fits into a small size, like 64K or 4K. So Pico 8 is a good platform for that. But I didn't expect the number and, quality of demos coming out for Pico 8 to be what it is. They're really quite delightful and phenomenal.
I think that in a world where computers are becoming infinitely powerful, I'm on an i9 with 20 odd processors and an NVIDIA 1080 that I just bought. And now apparently I need ray tracing because my 1080, you know, is now my $600 video card is now really $300 on Craigslist. And everyone says I should buy a fancy one. There seems to be a renaissance happening, and it is a renaissance of constraints. As we get infinite power, we want less, and we want to be put in a box, and then we want to push as far as we can against the outside of that box and see what we can do in a few K or a few pixels.
That's right. I think, with modern hardware, you can basically make anything you want. And as a designer, you get a little bit lost in that. So it's a nice feeling to come back to a constrained environment.
Yeah, constrained environments were where I started out, and one of my first big shareware games was on was on a Palm Pilot, and I had 4K of heap to work in, and that was it, and there was no math library. So you would find yourself trying to do something and saying, I don't have a library to call on. I can't just NPM install this. I have to write it from scratch. I'm seeing that people are creating first-person shooters, and you don't provide any engine. There's no Unity for Pico 8, is there?
No, it's really, so the most you get is a sprite drawing function. That's the most sort of advanced, you know, you can stretch one slice of a sprite, which is useful for drawing things like Wolf 3D walls. Mm-hmm. But yeah, apart from that, you need to, you don't even get a sorting function. If you need to sort things by Z, you have to figure out how to sort that. And you probably can't use emerge sort every frame or something like that. You know, you need to come up with tricks like doing incremental bubble sorts to, you know, keep everything in the right order so that something far away is not visibly in front of something that's close.
Have you ever thought about giving them that and saying that this is going to become more of an engine?
I think part of the fun of Pico 8 is, first of all, you know, having an excuse to revisit all of these classic graphics algorithms and writing things from scratch. Mm-hmm. But also for newer programmers to know that there is no magic and everything that you see in your program is built, you know, block by block, right down to drawing a pixel on the screen.
Mm, so they understand the metal, like this is the new metal. There's no, I've talked about this because I used to be a computer science professor, is that when I learned programming, and presumably when you did as well, I assume we're somewhere around the similar age, we learned on the metal, like here's a register and here's assembly language. And now for web developers, the metal is F12 tools and right. The metal is a JavaScript virtual machine. So why not make new metal?
Yeah. And I mean, sort of growing up in that era, learning. So, I mean, I'm still a C programmer and I really love the language being minimal. Mm. And, you know, you can poke inside any library and there's a kind of a vaguely similar programming style you can get your head around and things like this. So when I'm doing things like web development and suddenly I have all these libraries and all of this magic going on, it's very disconcerting and difficult to adjust.
So you're not comfortable with unlimited power?
Well, even if I'm using a system that gives me something like, sprite sorting, or it has like an animation system built in, the first thing I do is just instinctively throw it away and figure out how I can ignore it.
And you just either ignore it or do it yourself from scratch again?
Oh, well, I try to sort of do things the proper way and not reinvent the wheel. But I think it actually invariably blows up in my face and I need some feature that doesn't exist, or it's slow for some reason I don't understand, or something like this.
Mm-hmm. So folks can go to lexalawful.com and they can immediately just right off the bat hit the play button and they're playing a Pico 8 game in the browser. What is happening here? Is this a JavaScript implementation of the Fantasy Console?
Yeah, so it's actually compiled straight from my C source base I think the default one is still JavaScript. Asm.js is a subset of JavaScript that can be compiled. It can run very fast. You can write optimizers for it, knowing that it's a subset. And also WebAssembly, there's a WebAssembly version that's not actually live yet.
Mm-hmm. And then it also, people can go and get it on Windows, Mac, Linux, Raspberry Pi. And because you're writing it all in C, presumably you're writing it in portable C and just cross-compiling it for basically anything. So Pico 8 has the potentiality to run anywhere.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that's one of the features of this kind of system is that you can just write it once in one place and know that it's going to run roughly anywhere and look the same for other users. And that's one reason that Pico 8 has a sort of virtual CPU speed. So if you are on an incredibly fast machine and you write a program that is very expensive, it will, you know, artificially slow it down so it looks the same on a Raspberry Pi 1.
I see. So you can have you can throw unlimited power at it and potentially do things that you couldn't do on a lower powered machine. But for the most part, it does have a preferred and maximum speed so that all the games will run as they were expected to run.
Right. It's actually, I mean, in a way, it's part of the sort of aesthetically driven specification where I attribute CPU costs to different operations like drawing sprites and plotting pixels. Mm-hmm. And so when you're designing your game and your algorithm, you have to sort of work around these limits. And I think it helps designers, you know, leads designers down a path they wouldn't necessarily take.
Hi, friends. As a programmer, you think in objects. With MongoDB, so does your database. MongoDB is the most popular document-based database built for modern application developers and the cloud era. Millions of developers use MongoDB to power the world's most innovative products and services, from cryptocurrency to online gaming, IoT, and more. You can try MongoDB today with Atlas, the global cloud database service that runs on AWS, Azure, and Google Cloud. Configure, deploy, and connect to your database in just a few minutes. Check it out at mongodb.com/atlas. That's mongodb.com/atlas. Now, I went up there and started playing and got entranced, and I went and I purchased it, and it was $15 US, and I'm now able to run it anywhere. And when I downloaded Pico 8 and installed it, in my case on Windows, I noted that it isn't just a runner; it is its own, you know, IDE, for lack of a better word. You write Pico 8 apps with the Pico 8 tools,
right? And in fact, that's where it really started, was not as a virtual or fantasy console, but as a home computer called Lex 500 was the original title. Hmm. And the idea was that it would feel like a BBC Micro, which was one of the first machines I used. Mm-hmm. But it would make it easy to author content directly in the machine. So it's what I wish a BBC Micro was like. You know, you can write programs, but you can also just flip into a different screen and draw the sprites that you want to use in your program.
Yeah, you just flip kind of naturally back and forth between them. It even feels, though, a little bit constrained. One of the things that my son, my 11-year-old, who's working on a Pico 8 game right now, has found is that he feels that the font is so constrained that his eyes are blurring a little bit because it's all caps, it's a pixel-based font. Do you find, as you talk to your authors, do most people write their Pico 8 games entirely in the Pico 8 environment?
So it's around, I did a very informal poll on Twitter, which is very biased, but it was around 50-50 for people using the editor and using external tools. The font is terrible. It's sort of...
I'm glad that you said that.
I have no illusions about that. In fact, in the original design, I was really imagine like assuming that I would need to have a text mode or at least a sort of text overlay plane that you would write text to separately so that, you know, specifically so that I could use it in the code editor. But then I started fooling around with fonts and it started looking possible to the whole thing in 128 squared, which I never imagined was possible. And like that, so that idea was so pure and so, you know, so exciting to me at the time that there was no way that I could go back to something more practical. And that's kind of a common pattern in all of the areas of Pico 8's design. Like I sort of found something that was too sort of entertaining to me as a designer and programmer that I couldn't let it go. And I know that it's going to cause people trouble, but I, you know, I'm trying to cause people interesting and sort of funny trouble, not bad trouble, if I can make that distinction.
That is extremely well said, and that is a really good way to put it, because that's exactly what I felt. I was like, okay, this is cute, this is interesting, but you know, I'm old and my eyes hurt, so I want to figure out a way to do this. So I start poking around, and I learn about the cartridges and how they're stored, how the text is stored, and then I found a Visual Studio Code plugin that would allow me to write these things in a different editor and move seamlessly back and forth, taking the .p8 file and the source code between the two. And then now I can just write it in Visual Studio Code and hit F5, and it runs Pico 8. So it was a charming problem to have. It was not annoying in it by any means.
Yeah, I tried to make so there are two versions of the cartridge format. There is a sort of distributable image format, but there's also a default text format, which is, it's designed to be directly editable by a text editor so that you can sort of escape the font.
The idea that everything be self-contained, I think, though, is also part of its charm. Even the text-based format is effectively just one file. You don't have 15 different files that they all work together on. It's just one thing.
Right. I think one file is kind of convenient, but I suppose that's more of an implementation detail. Like, that if you never used an external editor, Pico 8 could completely hide that fact and it would just look the same. And then, you know, when you're sharing cartridges, you don't usually share the text file. You normally you normally save to clipboard and then paste it into an email or, you know, upload it to the server and send someone the ID to download it or something like that.
Yeah, certainly you could make this a virtual internal file system and hide all those details.
Right.
But then again, it wouldn't be quite so charming.
Yeah, I think .p8 files are kind of cute somehow. And it's nice to see the sprite data kicking around.
So the .p8 files are cute, but the part that took me a while, because you kind of casually mentioned it on the website, but it isn't, and forgive me, it just isn't immediately obvious what's going on. I was trying to figure out how I could download a cartridge and have it and possess it and email it to a friend. And I was looking for a download link and I was trying to figure out what am I supposed to right click on. And then it clicked that the PNG that looks like a little cartridge, it looks like a Nintendo Switch cartridge almost. It has a little notch on the side to indicate as if it's supposed to come in a certain way, is the game itself. The picture is the game.
Yeah, it's actually I didn't really think much of it when I decided to use that system, but later on it became clear, you know, how much that really adds to the feeling of using a virtual console thing, because you have these, like, just knowing that they're there on your disk and that they look like cartridges sort of completes the illusion to some degree.
The PNG is a picture of a cartridge. It says Pico 8. It has the website. It's got the name of the game. And then a screenshot of a moment in time in that particular game. Where is the instruction set? Where is the code?
So the code is wound into the low bits of the red, green, blue alpha data. And so one Pico 8 cartridge is a 32K block of just 8-bit data. And so when it writes to a P8 file, it's just, you know, writing in a sort of human readable text format. But when it's writing to a PNG file, it's generating the 32K, and then it's winding that information into the low bits of the color data.
So you just have enough slack room that's not visibly seen by us, because the PNG isn't filled with visible, and the colors that you're using are not complex enough that you needed that space. So you just squirrel away things in that space.
Yep, that's right. So there's, in a regular RGBA image, there are 32 bits available in one pixel. Mm-hmm. And so I use 8 of them. And you can't see it.
Now, does that, I worried, and maybe this is where I know just enough to be dangerous, as my dad says, I was worried that in the saving or in the transmitting or in the moving, it might be lost. Might I open it into a paintbrush program and save it and ruin it and ruin the data?
Yes, you can, unfortunately. There are some programs that, you know, will take the liberty of messing with those bits because, you know, to save space or whatever. And also, especially uploading to services like Twitter or Facebook, they're likely to do something to
interesting
to the image to crunch it smaller.
I see. So then do we know if tweeting a cartridge picture destroys its internal data?
It worked at one point. I haven't tried recently. I think Twitter has gradually been, you know, more aggressive in reducing image sizes. So, you know, understandably. So, you know, Pico 8 cartridges might have been some collateral damage.
Okay, but certainly emailing them, dragging them out of a browser, or saving them. As long as you don't open it, mess with it, and save it again in an optimizing PNG editor, you're probably okay.
Right. Yeah, I haven't heard of that breaking down yet.
Mm-hmm. So, in the days and weeks that I spent messing around with Pico 8, I assume I went through all of the stages. I mean, they're not stages of grief; they're stages of charm. Then you should probably document these stages at some point, right? There's that initial, like, what is this thing that I've discovered? I feel like I've found a corner of the internet, and I told my friends about it, and there was a pretty clear 50-50 split between people who knew what Pico 8 was and thought that it was amazing, and where have you been, Scott? You could have been with us all these years playing Pico 8 games. And then the other half was like, oh, that's amazing too. I want to do this as well. And then the next stage, somewhere around stage 3 or 4, was I want to physically take it with me. So I went and spent days trying to find the perfect physical hardware to run this console on. I don't think it exists today. Does it?
Yeah, I haven't found a handheld that I would recommend as, you know, the ideal machine for Pico 8. And it depends what people are using it for as well. If it's just for playing games, you know, there are a bunch of reasonable solutions like the what's it called? The Clockwork Pi. Mm-hmm. And
it was bundled with the Pocket Chip for a while there, but the Pocket Chip has a beautiful screen and, with all due respect to our friends at the Pocket Chip, a lousy keyboard.
Yeah, so that I really loved the Pocket Chip version apart from the keyboard. And the screen was miraculously suitable for Pico 8. It was 270 pixels high against Pico 8's 256. If you show each pixel,
if you double it, yeah,
doubled. So you get some black strips down the side, but it was actually pretty good. And it, you know, came with Wi-Fi, so you could interact with the BBS and things like that.
Mm-hmm. And the Clockwork Pi, and I'm going to have links to all of this in the show notes, is an interesting open source kind of portable kit that looks effectively like an idealized Game Boy modularized, and it's close, but unfortunately its pixels are not square.
Yeah, the pixels aren't square, and the resolution is a little bit awkward. Yeah, so there's always something just a little bit off. I think the closest that's currently available is not a handheld. It's an arcade cabinet. The Picade by Pi Moroni is 768, so you get perfect scaling. But the higher resolution models are high enough resolution that you can scale it and not see the difference.
It's interesting. It's almost part of its charm that it's not easy to do this. You know, I still feel like I can make it happen if I look enough, or I find the right part, or maybe if we publicly and gently shame the Clockwork Pi people, because you know it is a console that is modular. There's only simply one module per module in, you know, module type. Maybe they just need to get their screen situation under control.
So I don't have serious ambitions into creating this thing myself, but
I
you know, of course looked around at hardware suppliers, you know, just in case, to see what there was available. And it is a very, very awkward resolution. The first time I looked, I found, the very smallest possible resolution, 128 squared, that fits perfectly 1-to-1. There are millions and millions of surplus screens that size. It's really, you know, a good choice, because they are the same as Nokia 4000 series phones. And you know, a bunch of other devices use them. So there are some projects like TinyPi and I can't remember offhand what it's called, but that build little shells that, you know, just put some buttons and a screen and a battery around the Raspberry Pi. But the next biggest screen that I could find at that time was the 8K by 8K like observatory dome screen that is 40 meters across. So I really that was, you know, that also fits Pico 8 perfectly, but is not very practical and a little bit too large. So it, you know, it's very hard to find something square that is a power of two size in the middle.
The Tiny Pi is very, very close. It's got the 128 by 128 TFT, but then you what you get in screen you lose in buttons or mediocre, you know, it's 3D printed case.
I mean, I think that's the I think that's the most sort of viable possibility. And I did walk around for a number of months with a mocked up cardboard Pico 8 in my pocket with that screen size, just so I could pull it out at random times and sort of see how it felt. You know, is this too small? If you're focusing on it, it doesn't seem that bad. But it's definitely out for things like plugging a keyboard in and programming on it, which I think is a kind of an important aspect of the machine, even if it's portable.
Well, it's nice that you're leaving it to us to figure out. Like you said, this is a fantasy console, and that's part of the fantasy, is to try to figure out the perfect way to carry this around and do whatever you want. And I've got Pi. I have a 3D printed Game Boy here that I've got, which is a Pi with a nice screen. I could probably put Pico 8 on that. I've got a little one that is a Pi Girl, which is the Pi Game Boy clone from Adafruit. I could potentially do something with that. But it does need a machine with a little bit of heft, because we're not trying to be a low powered machine, right? This is not a real console.
Yeah, it's when I had the choice to make it efficient, you know, when I was choosing between efficiency and you know, design freedom, let's call it, I always chose design freedom. So so for example, I could have sort of limited the range of features of Lua that you could use. And if I had cut things like coroutines and also things like allowing infinite loops is a subtle one that I won't go into. It's quite hard to have infinite loops. You know, you need to be running it on an interpreter rather than compiling using JIT or something like that. So if I'd chosen those, then maybe it could run on something much, you know, lower powered. But at the moment, it needs around 700 megahertz or something like that.
Oh, wow. So what websites have come up around this? I've seen this thing called itch.io. These are these different indie game browsing places. People can get Pico 8 games in other places. Is that true, other than just at your website?
Yeah, I wanted to be sort of an unwalled garden. So it's very easy to export to binaries and HTML. And so many Pico 8 games are released on itch.io. There's more than 1,000 or 1,500 Pico 8 games there.
Wow. So that means that I could, as a consumer, download a game that looks amazing and never really know about the engine and the community behind it.
So when you run a Pico 8 game, it still comes up with the Pico 8 boot screen. So you know that it's a Pico 8 game, and it sort of frames what you're about to look at. I think it allows people to not worry too much about making super low resolution things. Because, you know, when you run a Pico 8 game, you sort of know what the deal is, and it has this, you know, there's a reason for it.
And there are a lot of great zines and educational tool sets that are out there. In fact, I'm going to have Dylan Bennett, who is creating educational content and game dev things and doing a lot of work on Pico 8. And he's created a really great Pico 8 toolkit, and basically a 72-page zine on how to do game development. So you've got people making amazing tutorials and algorithm step-by-steps, doing your documentation for you, making it even easier to learn.
Yeah, he calls it a zine. It's really a book. It's a really nice book, which
truly.
You know, you can just read it from start to finish, and you after that you basically have all the tools you need to make, you know, really any game. But I view the manual and the user guide, which aren't finished yet, as sort of part of the whole Pico 8 experience. So even though there's a great community of people making documentation and tutorials, it's sort of a nice nostalgic trip for me, trying to do things like explain variables to somebody for the first time. And so it's something I'm enjoying doing as well, is writing, you know, from scratch tutorials and kind of building the manual into something that looks like it could have been released in the 1980s.
And do you think that this is something that I should take to, for example, to my son's charter school and teach folks, like, this is a great first environment? It's the new Scratch. Why not teach Pico 8 rather than something else as a first language for kids?
I think it is a good first environment. But it, you know, Scratch does a different job. They have different roles. And I think Pico 8's role is kind of like I mentioned before, is to remove magic and give new programmers the feeling that they really can just make anything, you know, to really to show them what it's like to build a simple thing from nothing. And, you know, it only takes 5 or 10 lines to make quite a beautiful, interesting thing.
Yeah, I've even discovered a community on Twitter which are putting Pico 8 games in a tweet and seeing how fancy and how complicated it can get and fit in entirely in one tweet.
Yeah, so Twitter sort of created a sub-constraints genre for Pico 8. And most of the Pico 8 things that I released recently are also tweet cards. It's really fun trying to fit something in 280 characters.
Fantastic. Well, I'm going to include links to all of this stuff, to the Pico 8 user manual, the zines, the game development book, some great cheat sheets, the huge community wiki. And I would really encourage folks that are listening to go and check this out. Play your Pico 8 games, maybe share them with yourself, with your friends, with your family. If you're doing web development like me and you spend all day doing text boxes over data, it can really be a nice way to unwind and make a game in an environment like Pico 8. I really appreciate chatting with me today, Joseph.
Oh, thank you very much.
I've been talking with Joseph White, the creator of Pico 8. This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.